and welcome to Myth Matters, an exploration at the intersection of mythology, creativity, and consciousness. I'm your host, Dr. Catherine Svela. Wherever you may be in this wide, beautiful, crazy world of ours, I'm glad that you decided to join me here today. April is National Poetry Month here in the United States. Yay! I've participated in this celebration a number of years on the podcast. If you scroll back through April episodes of past seasons of Myth Matters, or go even further back to my earlier podcast, Myth in the Mojave, you'll find a variety of approaches to this topic. I've talked about the power of poetry to open our imagination and enhance empathy. I've talked about the intimate relationship between poetry and mythology. Many, perhaps the majority, of our earliest known recorded myths were originally long poems. Myth, the word myth, from Greek mythos, is generally agreed to be pre-Greek, unknown origin, a word that the Greeks came across and incorporated into their language. And mythos meant speech, thought, conversation, story, any of those forms, anything delivered by word of mouth. Poem, from the Greek poema, comes from the root poien, to make or complete. The ancient Greeks often referred to the art of the poet and the playwright as mythopoesis, the making of myth. I have interviewed a number of poets, Cynthia Anderson, Diane Sousa, and Greg Gilbert, for example, and talked about the subjects these poets entertained through this form. We also explored the power of poetry as a way of recording, discovering, and evolving the self. Poetry, writing poetry, is an excellent way to investigate your unique perspective on the world. And reading the poems of others is a valuable portal into the world of the poet and also your own. Sometimes we need to borrow the words of others to articulate our truth. Now, when I tell a story on this podcast, I often suggest that you pay attention to the moments or details that capture your attention, because I say these are clues. Clues to who you are in relation to the story at the moment. The same technique is very useful in approaching poetry. There are also a few episodes of poems, including episodes of poets and Myth Matters listeners reading poetry they love. Reading poetry is a valuable way to connect with the self, also the breath, voice, and body. Mythology has often been poetry, and myth and poetry have often been song. Well, in reflecting on past April poetry months, I realized that I have never talked about humor in poetry. Now, I could certainly use a laugh or a smile these days, and perhaps you can too. So today I have 10 or so poems to share with you that delight me in one way or another, and I have invited my longtime friend Rags Rosenberg to help me out with this today. Rags is a performing songwriter and poet, and I've interviewed him several times for April podcasts. I'm very grateful that he could join me today. Hello, Rags. I'm so excited that you agreed to join me for this episode. How are you?
I'm just fine. I'm really glad you invited me to do this here at the hotel where I currently work in Carmel. We're going to have our third annual National Poetry Month celebration right here at the hotel, you know, where I invite a few poets and we talk about why poetry can be important in your life. So I'm doing very well. Everything is good here. Thanks for asking.
Good, good, good. Well, you know, I know that you and I have talked about, and also, of course, you are a poet. So you know that when we talk about poetry, we talk about the love of language, the satisfaction in finding exactly the right word, our enjoyment in the nuances of meaning, creativity in all the figurative forms, a world expanding power of metaphor, you know, all of that. And yeah, I was really struck by the fact that at least I historically have considered all of those things from a fairly serious perspective. And that limits the engagement with poetry in a major way. I mean, Don't you think people come to poems, you expect to find the weighty truth?
Yeah, well, that's how people think of poetry and think of poets. And historically, it's actually pretty accurate, I think, for the most part. You know, because poetry can speak to things about our inner life that are difficult to otherwise articulate, because it's so image laden, like our dreams, and it's so full of metaphor. We don't think of it as a place where you can find humor, although there are some really wonderful humorous poems. People tend to diss that kind of poetry and the word they use for it is doggerel.
Right.
And like in a song, you would refer to it as a ditty, something that isn't really taken too seriously. And so it's very light. You know, it doesn't have the depth or the thoughtfulness that you would think of as poetry.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I agree with everything that you said. And at the same time, when I consider my inner life and my dreams, they are not without humor. Now, I'm not going to go into an overshare here or anything, but I have found it very useful to laugh often at the things that pop up in my psyche. And I'm thinking also of Freud's observation that one of the key way to locate the operation of psyche in your daily life is slips of the tongue and puns. That's the psyche really likes to pun.
Yeah.
I mean, there are many different forms of humor. You say ditties and doggerel. I get that. But when we talk about irony, satire, parody, all of those can have really serious targets. And then, of course, there is unabashed silliness. And I do have an unabashed silliness poem that I'm going to start us off with. But first, the caveat that funniness is a subjective judgment. So those of you out there, if you hate some of these poems and you don't think they're even remotely funny, what can I say? You have a little insight into the way my mind works. So, and Rags, you have at least one poem for us today, right?
I do.
A
funny poem.
Okay. This poem is Cinderella by Roald Dahl. Naturally, in my line of work, the fairy tale title is what attracted me. Here we go. I guess you think you know this story. You don't. The real one's much more gory. The phony one, the one you know, was cooked up years and years ago and made to sound all soft and sappy just to keep the children happy. Mind you, they got the first bit right. The bit where, in the dead of night, the ugly sisters, jewels and all, departed for the palace ball, while darling little Cinderella was locked up in a slimy cellar, where rats who wanted things to eat began to nibble at her feet. She bellowed, "Help!" and "Let me out!" The magic fairy heard her shout. Appearing in a blaze of light, she said, "My dear, are you all right?" "All right," cried Cindy. "Can't you see? I feel as rotten as can be." She beat her fist against the wall and shouted, "Get me to the ball. There is a disco at the palace. The rest have gone and I am jealous. I want a dress, I want a coach, and earrings and a diamond brooch, and silver slippers, two of those, and lovely nylon pantyhose. Done up like that, I'll guarantee the handsome prince will fall for me." The fairy said, "Hang on a tick." She gave her wand a mighty flick, and quickly, in no time at all, Cindy was at the palace ball. It made the ugly sisters wince to see her dancing with the prince. She held him very tight and pressed herself against his manly chest. The prince himself was turned to pulp. All he could do was gasp and gulp. Then midnight struck. She shouted, "Heck, I've got to run to save my neck." The prince cried, "No, alas, alack." He grabbed her dress to hold her back. As Cindy shouted, "Let me go," the dress was ripped from head to toe. She ran out in her underwear and lost one slipper on the stair. The prince was on it like a dart. He pressed it to his pounding heart. "The girl, this slipper fits," he cried. "Tomorrow morn shall be my bride. I'll visit every house in town until I've tracked that maiden down." Then rather carelessly, I fear, he placed it on a crate of beer. At once, one of the ugly sisters, the one whose face was blotched with blisters, sneaked up and grabbed the dainty shoe and quickly flushed it down the loo. Then in its place, she calmly put the slipper from her own left foot. Aha, you see, the plot grows thicker and Cindy's luck starts looking sicker. Next day, the prince went charging down to knock on all the doors in town. In every house, the tension grew. Who was the owner of the shoe? The shoe was long and very wide. A normal foot got lost inside. Also, it smelled a wee bit icky. The owner's feet were hot and sticky. Thousands of eager people came to try it on, but all in vain. Now came the ugly sister's go. One tried it on. The prince screamed, "No!" But she screamed, "Yes, it fits, whoopee! So now you've got to marry me." The prince went white from ear to ear. He muttered, "Let me out of here." "Oh, no, you don't. You made a vow. There's no way you can back out now." "Off with her head," the prince roared back. They chopped it off with one big whack. This pleased the prince. He smiled and said, "She's prettier without her head." Then up came sister number two, who yelled, "Now I will try the shoe." "Try this instead," the prince yelled back. He swung his trusty sword and smack, her head went crushing to the ground. It bounced a bit and rolled around. In the kitchen, peeling spuds, Cinderella heard the thuds of bouncing heads upon the floor and poked her own head round the door. "What's all the racket?" Cindy cried. "Mind your own biz," the prince replied. For Cindy's heart was torn to shreds. "My prince," she thought, "he chops off heads. How could I marry anyone who does that sort of thing for fun?" The prince cried, "Who's this dirty slut? Off with her nut, off with her nut." Just then, all in a blaze of light, the magic fairy hove in sight. Her magic wand went swoosh and swish. "Cindy," she cried, "come make a wish. Wish anything and have no doubt that I will make it come about." Cindy answered, "Oh, kind fairy, this time I shall be more wary. No more princes, no more money. I have had my taste of honey. I'm wishing for a decent man. They're hard to find. Do you think you can?" Within a minute, Cinderella was married to a lovely feller, a simple jam maker by trade who sold good homemade marmalade. Their house was filled with smiles and laughter, and they were happy ever after.
Oh, my God. That is precious. That is so good. Oh, I love it. Well, it definitely, you know, it takes the story in a different direction. Good for him.
And the rhyming. I mean, it does seem like these sing-songy rhymes are one of the things that often makes a poem funny, certainly makes it fun to read. I mean, was super fun to read, but yeah. Is also one of the things that now makes poems seem unsophisticated.
Yeah, that's true. And also, it's just a technical thing, but what they call feminine rhymes, where you have a two-syllable word and the and two syllable words rhyme, and the first the emphasis is on the first syllable. So like, what was that line with the honey in it?
Let's see. She says, "No more princes, no more money. I have had my taste of honey."
Yeah, money, honey, those kinds of rhymes where they're two syllables and the emphasis is on the first syllable tend to be funny. And you find, you know, and you've seen a bunch of them in that poem.
Well, I have one other one. It's not as good, I have to say, but there's something I get a kick out of. If you Google funny poems, I'll spare you a lot of trouble. Don't go to the first 15 results that'll come up in your searches. Not only do they give the same poems over and over again, but they're a great example of some of the sort of dumb things. And, you know, reading them, I was thinking, wow, we so associate silliness and just a good chuckle with childhood. I mean, why do we have to think of the business of being an adult as something that's so extraordinarily drab, I wonder? So this one, it's not of the same caliber, but I think it's pretty funny. It's called "Mother Doesn't Want a Dog" by Judith Viorst. Mother doesn't want a dog. Mother says they smell and never sit when you say sit, or even when you yell. When you come home late at night and there is ice and snow, you have to go back out because the dumb dog has to go. Mother doesn't want a dog. Mother says they shed and always let the strangers in and bark at friends instead. They do disgraceful things on rugs and track mud on the floor and flop upon your bed at night and snore their doggy snore. Mother doesn't want a dog. She's making a mistake, because more than a dog, I think she will not want this snake. Yes. Well, I grew up with a mom who really didn't want a dog. And then my childhood dog, Scamp, ended up being attached to her more than anyone else.
Oh, yeah. That's funny. Yeah.
Yes.
The way it works sometimes, huh? The dog,
right.
the dog decides.
That's right. The dog does decide.
Right.
The dog does decide.
Well, that's a good poem. I enjoyed that. Yeah. I thought that was good.
Yeah. And, you know, she is the author of a self-help book that was really popular, I think in the late 70s, maybe, called Necessary Losses. So one does not have to be completely divorced from the serious realities of adult life to be able to find some humor in some of this.
Right. Well, the thing is, like, about that poem is that one of the, for a funny poem to be good, there has to be something about it that is actually true, I think. And in that poem, you know, it's everything she says about the dog jumping up on the bed, about snoring and all, it's also, you know, it's what happens, you know. And then the idea that, oh, she doesn't want a dog, but what if she sees the snake, you know?
It's right.
Like, it's like, okay, yeah, I get that.
Right. It occurs to me that there's that a lot of the poems that I like, that I find humorous, they're silly, obviously, or there's a certain slyness, or they go against the grain. You know, they dismantle our sentimentality in some way. And that's one form of, you know, in the larger category of making the unexpected turn, which is the thing that I really enjoy in poetry. When a poem not only shows me something new, you know, again, in the elevated sense, but does that by turning a corner and having me go, whoa, wow, I never even saw that coming.
You know, in songwriting, they call that ringing the bell.
Oh, ringing the bell.
Ringing the bell. It's the line that sets up the hook of the song. Each time it comes around in the chorus, the line that sets it up has to be stronger. and offer a different angle into it, you know. And it's, so you keep at the beginning of the song, you know, is the song, and then as the song progresses and these setup lines get stronger and stronger and give new and new meaning to the title of the song, it, you know, it gives, it's like a punchline, you know, when you're telling a joke. If you start with a punchline, it's not much of a joke. You know, you got to build up to it. And both of those poems you read did that.
I like that. Well, this line of thinking, this unexpected and the going against the grain, the sentimentality, one thing I looked for was an anti-love poem to see if anyone did anything funny. And I found this poem by Ross Gay. It's a poet I have been enjoying a lot over the last few years, called Love, I'm Done With You. Love, I'm Done With You by Ross Gay. You ever wake up with your footy PJs warming your neck like a noose? Ever upchuck after a home-cooked meal? Or notice how the blood on the bottoms of your feet just won't seem to go away? Love, it used to be you could retire your toothbrush for like 2 or 3 days, and still I'd push my downy face into your neck. Used to be I hung on your every word. Sing, you'd say, and I was a bird. Freedom, you'd say, and I never really knew what that meant, but liked the way it rang like a rusty bell. Used to be, but now. I can tell your breath stinks and you're full of shit. You have more lies about yourself than bodies beneath your bed. Rooting for the underdog, team player, hook, line, and sinker. Love, you helped design the brick that built the walls around the castle, in the basement of which is a vault, inside of which is another vault, inside of which, you get my point. Your tongue is made of honey, but flicks like a snake. Voice like a bird, but everyone's ears are bleeding. From the inside, your house shines and shines, but from outside you can see it's built from bones. Wow. From out here, it looks like a graveyard, and the garden's all ash. And besides, your breath stinks. We're through.
Wow. Wow, Ron.
Yeah, don't you wonder who he wrote that for?
That's the anti-love poem. You found it.
See, I think this is funny, but it also brought me to another thought about humor in poetry. And it's not, this issue isn't limited to poetry, but it's the ambiguity of the intention of the author. You know, if you go to watch stand-up comedy, whether or not the person is funny, you know that's their intent.
Right.
But with the poet, unless you have a few of their poems so that you can compare and you kind of get into this, their groove, you don't necessarily know if they're trying to be funny.
Hmm. I guess some of them might be a little more difficult if you have no context and you don't know the poet. Maybe you would take them more seriously. And I could see where that one you could. I mean, I hope it's not autobiographical, poor guy.
Well, he wrote a fantastic book on joy, so I think he's okay no matter what. Uh-huh. Well, when I think about the unexpected turn and humor and a building of humor, you know, the more poems you read, the more just the light comes on inside. I think of Billy Collins.
Yeah.
I have a couple of his poems that I wanted to read. This poem by Billy Collins called Litany, maybe a fitting follow-up along the theme of going against the grain a little bit. Mm-hmm. Of our sentimentality, dismantling a little what we take as serious. So this is Litany by Billy Collins, and it begins with a little epigraph. You are the bread and the knife, the crystal goblet and the wine, by Jacques Crillon. You are the bread and the knife, the crystal goblet and the wine. You are the dew on the morning grass and the burning wheel of the sun. You are the white apron of the baker and the marsh birds suddenly in flight. However, you are not the wind in the orchard, the plums on the counter, or the house of cards. And you are certainly not the pine-scented air. There's just no way that you are the pine-scented air. It is possible that you are the fish under the bridge, maybe even the pigeon on the general's head, but you are not even close to being the field of cornflowers at dusk. And a quick look in the mirror will show that you are neither the boots in the corner nor the boat asleep in its boathouse. It might interest you to know, speaking of the plentiful imagery of the world, that I am the sound of rain on the roof.
Mm.
I also happen to be the shooting star. Mm. The evening paper blowing down an alley and the basket of chestnuts on the kitchen table.
Wow.
I am also the moon in the trees and the blind woman's teacup. But don't worry. I am not the bread and the knife. You are still the bread and the knife. You will always be the bread and the knife, not to mention the crystal goblet and somehow the wine.
Oh, that's lovely.
Isn't it?
Really lovely. Yeah. It, you know, the thing about his poetry, especially in those ones that have some humor in them, is, you know, they're not just funny poems. There's humor in them, but the poem has something in it that's beyond the humor. You know, the humor serves something else. That's what I really like about that. So
right.
That brings to mind a poem. Maybe you'll allow me to read it to you, that called When I Die.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember that Dave Carter song, When I Die? Mm-hmm. This is my version.
Okay.
When I Die, after Dave Carter. When I die, I won't be a whisper on the wind. I won't be a single flake in the gentle white snowfall. I won't be a great eagle or a gray wolf or the slow travel of the clouds overhead. I won't be a new bud on the old oak tree or a twinkling constellation in the summer sky. No, I'll be the stubborn spot on your carpet where your lover's dog did his business. I'll be the broken vacuum you can't afford to fix, the leak in your roof and the stain on your ceiling. I'll be the scratch on the lens, the molar that aches to be pulled, the itch you can't reach, the bandage that won't stick, the troubling dark spot on your x-ray. Look for me. You won't have far to look. I'll be around.
Oh, my goodness. The vacuum I can't afford to fix. Well, I'm looking forward to your presence in my life from the afterlife, Rags.
I'm sure.
Thank you for that. Is that poem in any of your available poetry books or on your website or anything?
It is not yet. No.
Okay. Okay. No. Okay. Well, you let me know when it is.
I will.
Well, so this is a little bit of a redirection, since I don't have anything to offer. I haven't written a poem about my afterlife, but I do have another one from Billy Collins that I want to read.
Okay.
Called The Lanyard.
Oh, yes.
The Lanyard.
I love this one. I'm glad you're reading it.
Oh, good. The other day, I was ricocheting slowly off the blue walls of this room, moving as if underwater from typewriter to piano, from bookshelf to an envelope lying on the floor, when I found myself in the L section of the dictionary, where my eyes fell upon the word lanyard. No cookie nibbled by a French novelist could send one into the past more suddenly, a past where I sat at a workbench at a camp by a deep Adirondack lake, learning how to braid long, thin plastic strips into a lanyard, a gift for my mother. I had never seen anyone use a lanyard, or wear one, if that's what you did with them, But that did not keep me from crossing strand over strand again and again until I had made a boxy red and white lanyard for my mother. She gave me life and milk from her breasts, and I gave her a lanyard. She nursed me in many a sick room, lifted spoons of medicine to my lips, laid cold face cloths on my forehead, and then led me out into the airy light and taught me how to walk and swim, and I, in turn, presented her with a lanyard. "Here are thousands of meals," she said, "and here is clothing and a good education. Here is your lanyard," I replied, which I made with a little help from a counselor. "Here is a breathing body and a beating heart, strong legs, bones, and teeth, and two clear eyes to read the world," she whispered. "And here," I said, "is the lanyard I made at camp. And here," I wish to say to her now, "is a smaller gift, not the worn truth, that you can never repay your mother, but the rueful admission that when she took the two-tone lanyard from my hand, I was as sure as a boy could be that this useless, worthless thing I wove out of boredom would be enough to make us even."
Oh, Billy Collins, you go, boy.
Do you have a favorite Billy Collins poem that you'll read?
Let me get to it here. This is a poem called The Revenant. That I've always loved of Billy Collins. And just as we've discussed, this is, you know, it's funny as heck. And yet beneath it, there's something he's getting at. Anyway, The Revenant by Billy Collins. I am the dog you put to sleep, as you like to call the needle of oblivion. Come back to tell you this simple thing. I never liked you. Not one bit. When I licked your face, I thought of biting off your nose. When I watched you toweling yourself dry, I wanted to leap and unman you with a snap. I resented the way you moved, your lack of animal grace, the way you would sit in a chair and eat, a napkin on your lap, knife in your hand. I would have run away, but I was too weak. A trick you taught me while I was learning to sit and heal and, greatest of insults, shake hands without a hand. I admit the sight of the leash would excite me, but only because it meant I was about to smell things you had never touched. You do not want to believe this, but I have no reason to lie. I hated the car, the rubber toys, disliked your friends, and worse, your relatives. The jingling of my tags drove me mad. You always scratched me in the wrong place. All I ever wanted from you was food and fresh water in my metal bowls. While you slept, I watched you breathe as the moon rose in the sky. It took all my strength not to raise my head and howl. Now I am free of the collar, the yellow raincoat, monogrammed sweater, the absurdity of your lawn. And that is all you need to know about this place, except what you have already supposed and are glad it did not happen sooner, that everyone here can read and write, the dogs in poetry, the cats and the others in prose.
Oh, I love that. The perspective of the dog.
Yeah, it's a great poem.
So that's the second funny dog poem we've had. And is there any way we can do a fairy tale three and have three funny dog poems, I wonder?
I think that we could probably accomplish that. I actually have one that I wrote. I wrote for our dog, Steinbeck.
Oh, you're kidding.
This is a poem called Lament. Doesn't sound like a funny poem, does it?
No, it does not.
Lament. When they took my balls, I limped around the backyard for a week, not sure what had happened or why. That was a long time ago, but I still remember the details of the event like it was yesterday. When they took my balls, They hid the raw wound beneath a clean white woven bandage so I couldn't lick it. I was a whelp then, still in my magic, and still today, though they don't suspect it, I remember who and what I was. When they took my balls, they dropped them into a clear plastic baggie, the kind they use for their lunch sandwiches, and dropped the baggie into a clean stainless steel trash can marked hazardous waste. Hazardous waste? Can you believe it? Just as well. I had no further use for them. Can't sew them back on. When they took my balls, I was embarrassed to be seen. I lay on my small bed on the bedroom floor, concealing my shame. I concealed my shame then and since. Can't say why. After all, I'd done nothing wrong. I was a good dog. I tried hard to follow the sounds coming out of their mouths, repeated sounds, sounds that seemed to indicate some action required on my part. I'd been trying really hard, doing my very best when they took my balls.
Well, that reminds me that humor, once again, is very much a matter of perspective, right?
Yeah.
But it's a funny word. Balls.
It
balls is a funny word, especially in a poem. It's time for us to wrap this up, alas, but it takes me to one other poem that just feels so perfectly fitting. It's called Frau Freud, Mrs. Freud, yes, and it's by Carol Ann Duffy.
Ah.
Frau Freud. Ladies, for argument's sake, let us say that I've seen my fair share of ding-a-ling, member, and jock, of todger and nudger and percy and cock, of tackle, of three for a bob, of willy and winky. In fact, you could say I'm as au fait with Hunt the Salami as Ms. M. Lewinsky, equally sick up to here with the beef bayonet, the pork soid, the savloy, love muscle, night crawler, dong, the dick, prick, dipstick, and wick, the rammer, the slammer, the Rupert, the schlong. Don't get me wrong. I've no axe to grind with the snake in the trousers, the wife's best friend, the weapon, the python. I suppose what I mean is, ladies, dear ladies, the average penis, not pretty. The squint of its envious solitary eye, one's feeling of pity.
Oh, that's great.
There you have it.
That's really great.
There you have it, right? Good. The joy of language, the silliness, the slyness, the dismantling of sentiment, the unexpected turn.
Mm-hmm.
All right there in one poem.
I love that poem. I have one more I'd like to share with you, if it's okay. And it's one that I wrote about being a poet, about being a writer. And it's called Blessing.
Okay.
When the muse delivers the goods to your door, may you be sufficiently shit-faced to invite her in. May you be ruthless enough to toss your firstborn back into the shallows, brave enough to suffer your ill-conceived metaphors, lazy cliches, shameless plagiarisms, and just plain bad ideas. May you be foolish enough, despite all of that, to forge ahead. May the clever ideas pass you by and find some other sucker, while you continue to circle that one nagging question you're still trying to articulate. May you never be granted a laurel upon which to rest, not even for a moment. May you die as reviled as Joyce, as penniless as Poe.
That's a heck of a career that you imagine there. And in this moment, that line about being foolish enough to go on. Thank you so much for joining me and for throwing your poems into the mix.
Yeah.
I loved it.
Great. Yeah. Well, I really appreciate that you do this every year in April, you know, and help us celebrate National Poetry Month. It's a great service you provide. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well,
I have one other poem that we're going to close with, but first, a big welcome to new email subscribers, Susan, Catherine, Robin, Jackie, Stephen, and Sam. Welcome to Myth Matters. If you're new to Myth Matters, I invite you to head over to the Mythic Mojo website. You will find a transcript of this episode, information about my mentorship and consulting services, and you can also join the email list if you would like to receive links to new Myth Matters episodes in your inbox. Thank you to Kim for becoming a patron of Myth Matters. The Patreon patrons and Bandcamp supporters of Myth Matters make this podcast possible. If you're finding something of value here at Myth Matters, I hope you'll consider joining them. And if this isn't possible, post a positive review or comment. And thank you for your support of the show. It means a lot. This foray into humor and poetry to celebrate National Poetry Month 2024 reminded me of my college days and an old favorite, Edna St. Vincent Millay. In closing, here are a few very short verses from her collection, Figs from Thistles. First fig. My candle burns at both ends. It will not last the night. But ah, my foes and oh, my friends, it gives a lovely light. Second fig. Safe upon the solid rock the ugly houses stand. Come and see my shining palace built upon the sand. The Unexplorer. There was a road ran past our house, too lovely to explore. I asked my mother once, she said, that if you followed where it led, it brought you till the milkman's door. That's why I have not traveled more. And on that note, and with tongue firmly in cheek, I want to say thank you once again to Rags Rosenberg for joining me today. I will share his Instagram and website with the transcript of this episode. And I hope one of these poems provided you with a laugh or a smile. Is there a poem that you're currently enjoying? Please share it with me. You can post it in the comments for this episode or email me. Both options are available at my website, mythicmojo.com. And that's it for me, Catherine Savela and Myth Matters. Thank you so much for listening. Take good care of yourself, and until next time, read some great poetry and keep the mystery in your life alive.